like to open up the floor to questions and maybe take advantage of the privilege of the chair to come back at some of the issues that Nenad raised concerning first the desire for change to bring about a stable solution for Bosnia, and then who's really affecting change at this point. Do you, and this is directed pretty much to everybody on our panel, do you see the EU being able to overcome its divisions at this point? Or what's it going to what will it take for the EU to overcome its divisions at this point to be able to provide this unified front to deal with Bosnia in the way that in the fairly forceful way that it sounds like is going to be needed to get people to focus? And secondly, what is the position of Russia and let's say Muslim powers in affecting the political calculus for both the leaders of Republika Srpska and for the Bosnia-Croatian Federation?
Okay. Yeah, the unity of the EU is with respect to its policy in Bosnia is a very important question. Things are better now than they were in the middle of last year and late last year, when really there was a sense of lack of interest, fatigue with Bosnia. Why do we keep hearing about Bosnia? There was a kind of sense when you spoke to people in Brussels that they just wished the whole thing would go away. That has changed. There is more attention in the member state capitals and more attention in Brussels to what is actually happening in Bosnia, which is a good thing. But there is still more work to do, and I don't believe that all of the important member states have really fully realized what is happening in Bosnia and Herzegovina and fully realized their own responsibility. As the organization that Bosnia aspires to join, and that is taking on a certain stabilizing role in the period after the closure of the Office of the High Representative. The United States has an important role to play in drawing Europe's attention to this and in helping Europe formulate and implement its policy in Bosnia-Herzegovina, but it's important that the U.S. work with and through its European allies. This is not just because Europe has, you know, a long track record of doing very well in Bosnia. It doesn't. It's not because they have brilliant ideas. They don't. It's because Europe taking the lead is right both for U.S. interests and for Bosnia, which will be joining Europe, not the U.S. And moreover, also because one of the most important international tasks in the next few years will be mediating and facilitating a political discussion, a wide-ranging political discussion among Bosnian politicians about the shape of their country, constitutional order of their country, and a neutral party is better placed to do that service. And in some segments, the U.S. is not really seen as fully neutral, which can be a disadvantage. The second part of your question, there is of course, Russian influence. Russian interest in this part of the Balkans waxes and wanes. It's driven by political relations within a very small circle of Moscow. Is not a lasting element of Russian foreign policy. It's certainly not the case that they are pulling the strings. And the policy of Banja Luka is set by Banja Luka. And it responds broadly to the opinions and beliefs of the Bosnian Serbs. So democracy is actually working in this case. With respect to the Muslim world, it has a very attenuated influence in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Very attenuated. There are some commercial links, but you know, many Gulf countries, for example, that are interested in investing in Bosnia and Herzegovina are also exploring investments in Croatia and in Bulgaria, okay, not Muslim countries. So it's more of a commercial relationship than a religious one. And if you're, I don't know if you were meaning to allude to radical Islam, something that is and has been present in Bosnia for years. This is a very small and marginal, okay, possibly smaller than in parts of Western Europe. So it's something that, you know, we need to be aware of, certainly continue monitoring, but not something that could cause for any kind of imminent alarm.
Can I disagree with Marco?
Go right ahead, Nenad.
Marco, one fact. All public radio stations in Bosnia, except for one local station, broadcast religious programs. But a lot of these programs dedicated to one confession. Only one. Religious program is broadcast by 57% radio stations, out of which 75% of stations broadcast program dedicated to one confession. The two biggest centers, media centers, that were built up in Bosnia last several years, in Auschwitz, in Sarajevo, are financed by Iran and Saudi Arabia. So there is a religious element, I believe, very strong one. I'm just to make clear, I'm Catholic, so I'm in Croats. So that you know that I'm not in favor of, but I'm an RFURL employee. I'm not Croat by profession.
Okay. Can I ask a couple of questions here in Washington and then take one in Prague?
Okay. Hello. Yeah, my name is Mike Henning. I guess I shall stand. I'm with USAID. I served in Bosnia from 2002 to 2006, trying to promote democracy, and can't admit a lot of success. Constitutional reform happened at the end of my tenure, and it's definitely something we would not have encouraged from a political development side. It was a sort of a diplomatic effort in the United States, but it was really, honest, awfully timed, because it put the current players in power, allowed Šeligić to come back in, and here we are. I think I have a lot of questions, though, about what ICG is proposing here, because I think that it's been tried. As Nenad said so well, 15 years on, you know, the Bosnians have had a lot of chances to do things, and they haven't. I think that if you mediate and facilitate a wide-ranging discussion by Bosnian politicians, as Marco suggests, partition is what they're going to come up with. I mean, there's no other logical conclusion. Certain groups would never go back from what they have right currently under Dayton, which Dayton locks in a very unstable structure, and certain groups will never give that up. And so the idea that this will lead to something, and I think when you compare Bosnia to other EU accession countries, it's really not fair to say, well, other EU accession countries had to change their constitutions. No other EU country or accession country, maybe I'm wrong on this, lacks a majority ethnicity. Bosnia has no majority ethnic group. It has a system that locks in, you know, balance of power amongst three ethnic groups. So to expect those groups to work things out without a majority group that kind of can control things, the ethnic question is always going to be dominant, and that's because they have a plurality in the country. And also no other EU accession countries have went through a war that killed over 100,000 people and that sort of thing. So I would question that point. And as far as Russian interest, I would say maybe it waxes and wanes, but it's absolutely waxing at the moment, and with no end in sight. I think the ease of fomenting problems in the Balkans for Russian politicians is simple. You know, you just send an ambassador up to Banja Luka and you've created some good news back in Moscow. And so why wouldn't you do that forever? Maybe there'll be some enlightenment in the Russian political system sometime in the future, but that's not going to happen anytime soon. And the great example, of course, is Kosovo. Kosovo is going nowhere because of Russian and Serbian and Russian blocking, and we know that to be the case. And so, you know, and EU itself can't get together on what Kosovo is. And so I don't think EU unity is going to be coming anytime soon. I think Russian role will continue to be the spoiler. And so I just sort of, I question several of your premises, and I think that gets to the point that Nenad said, this needs to be imposed from the outside. I mean, several people like Daniel Server from USIP and others have called for a Dayton 2. This is totally contradictory to what you're proposing, but I think that their proposal is far more likely to succeed if we want anything to happen in Bosnia in the next 10 to 20 years. Thanks.
There are a number of things that that are just not right in the comment. And thank you for the comment. Let me just begin with close to the end. The peak of Russian influence in Bosnia was last summer. It has been waning since then. Read a note: the relatively mild Peace Implementation Council steering board communiqué of June of last year, from which the Russians dissented. The subsequent two communiqués and subsequent Security Council resolutions have all been much more strongly worded and much more critical of the Bosnian Serbs, and there's been no Russian dissent. And this is corroborated by what I hear speaking to members of the diplomatic corps in Sarajevo. So it is, you know, it does come and go, and it is now declining. It might come back later, not to say that it won't. It's also not true that Bosnia lacks majority. It's almost certainly true that Bosniaks now compose well over 50% of the population, probably about 55%, largely as a result of out-migration by the others. We will know in a number of years when there is a census. There hasn't been a census since 1991, but this seems to be likely. It's also not true, and here I disagree with respect with you and with Nenad, that nothing has changed in the past, since Dayton. Bosnia has changed out of recognition. If you think back to what it was like in the beginning of 1996, when you could not travel across the inter-entity boundary line, when there really was no central government, when, you know, the office of the Bosnian Serb member of the presidency was next door to the office of Radovan Karadzic, the hunted war criminal, and compare that to today, when there is a single armed force, right? When there is a single Bosnian justice system with jurisdiction throughout the entire country, which is, at least in its war crime component, not opposed by the Bosnian Serbs, when there is a single investigation agency, yes, with many dysfunctional components to it, but nonetheless, one that does function and that does do some of its job, and a great many other reforms. There is a single fiscal council that actually agrees and functions on many things. These are all significant achievements of the past, decade and a half. And it's to be hoped that such achievements will continue. And finally, I would say I really hope you are wrong that when you say that all they could agree on is partition. They might be able to agree on the principle of partition, on the desirability of going their separate ways. They certainly could not agree on where the lines are to be drawn. And they all know that. They're all aware of that. And they're all aware that the implications of trying to achieve a partition in those circumstances are disastrous for all of them. And that the regional climate is wholly unpropitious, completely unlike what it was in 1991, 1992, when you had a war raging and just barely ending in next door Croatia. Now you have Croatia as a member of NATO. Okay, it could not be more different. And this notion of imposing something on them is profoundly dangerous. The specific thing that Nenad proposed imposing, which was to eliminate the importance of ethnicity and to make it a private category, this is something that would be flatly rejected by the vast majority of Bosnian Serbs and the vast majority of Bosnian Croats. So it could only be done against their will. And I do not believe it can be done peacefully. So we should be aware of what we are playing with when we propose this kind of thing. We are proposing to impose a solution against the will of a substantial minority of the country with a substantial risk of violence. So if you thought that the failure of the 2006 constitutional process was expensive and brought us to where we are now in some ways, you can only imagine what the failure of that kind of process might entail.
Can I just add a few points, especially, I mean, just on the issue of Russia, because that's come up twice. Russia, of course, is investing in the Western Balkans, has invested in Brod, as Mena brought up, has invested substantially in Serbia. But this is what can be called checkbook diplomacy on the Russian side. And while the global economic crisis is seriously impacting the Russian economy, it is going to be difficult for Russia to continue along that kind of, using that kind of checkbook diplomacy. This is not Transnistria or Crimea or South Ossetia. Russia is not distributing passports, is not providing pensions, is not trying to somehow convert the Serbs into Russians. Russia really has only a limited amount of leverage in Republika Srpska, financial leverage, which, as I said, is increasingly weakened. The other thing is that the Serbs themselves don't trust the Russians. I mean, the Serbs themselves in Serbia suffered significantly from the gas cuts of this winter, and they see Russians as a temporary ally, an ally that they can benefit from, but they're not going to sell their souls to Moscow. Which is the case, perhaps, in parts of the former Soviet Union. So I would say here that even Russia itself understands that, yes, it can create some difficulties in the Western Balkans, but it's not going to take over in the way that it does in its own spheres of influence, as it calls itself, parts of the Caucasus and even Ukraine. So it's very different, I think, the position of Russia in the Western Balkans. What I wanted to also reinforce is what Marco said about the dangers of imposing anything. When the Dayton Agreement was signed, let's remember the situation was completely different. We had 60,000 NATO troops in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Who is now going to impose a solution with military force? If we're not going to do it with military force, then how are we going to do it? Kofi Annan tried to impose a solution on Cyprus and wasn't able to do that. How are we going to manage to do it in Bosnia? I think that at this point we need to be much more realistic about our own capabilities, our own abilities to bring peace and stability, and to realize that Bosnia is on a long track. As Marco has said, there's been significant changes. Bosnia does not look at all like it did in 1995. I'll add to what he said also return. People have returned to their homes. Minorities are living in Republika Srpska and in the Federation. Yes, if we look at countries of the European Union, the country that I come from Belgium, is also a half-half country, where we are constantly arguing about issues of federalism and how to divide power. And our government is very often unfunctional as well. So Bosnia, I think, is going to have to go through that kind of a policy, a very long-term one, where, yes, things are not moving as fast as we would like to see them, but inevitably peace and stability is still secured.
Hi, my name is Jared Toll. I'm a professor at Virginia Tech. I'm an academic. I've done work on Bosnia and for the last decade. I have a book coming out on the returns process next year. I'm very sort of puzzled. Like, when has an international crisis group become essentially European Stability Initiative? Because, you know, in one sense, this is the rhetoric you're giving me is really very much like that. And, you know, in the one of the values of the reports down the years is the understanding that the OHR, through the use of the bond powers, was actually able to get things done. And I can testify to that at the, you mentioned the returns process would not have happened without impositions and without the threat of removals. So at the local level, mayors were able to do the right thing in order to let people go back to their homes or sell their homes and things like that. So there's a track record of a strong international intervention and the OHR having a positive influence in building a light state within Bosnia. On the other hand, there's not a track record, it seems to me, of the kind of aspirations that are the double aspiration that is in your argument, which is the aspiration that the European Union can come together, all the different actors can come together and have a coherent policy on the one hand, and on the other hand, that the forces in Bosnia can come together. And I was struck by the fact that none of you mentioned the Dodik and the referendum issue. And, you know, maybe that's a kind of a exhibit number one for those who are alarmist about Bosnia. And certainly that is the case. There's a whole rhetoric on that. But nevertheless, you didn't mention it. And so I wonder why. And, you know, what is the kind of the basis, or how would you kind of conceptualize what you're arguing now and how it's different from ESI? Thanks.
Well, I can reassure you. I just met with the executive director of ESI in Bosnia last week, and they said we completely disagree with your last report. and there are I actually have a lot of respect for ESI, so I don't take this as a criticism. Your comment, but having said that, we do call for the High Representative to remain in office until the fixed conditions are met. We do call for him to retain and, if necessary, use the bond powers. These are not ESI positions. Okay. In fact, they are not even crisis group positions of 2 years ago. Okay. So we have, in some ways, sharpened our position in Bosnia. In this report, in recognition of the seriousness of the current situation, but we don't believe that it's possible. And there are relatively few people, and I think virtually none in the international community in Bosnia, who believe it's possible to go back to the state-building role of the OHR of, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. The time for that has simply passed for a variety of reasons. Sabine alluded to the drastic decline in military force, where it's apparently impossible even to retain the current 2,000 troops that you have in Bosnia-Herzegovina. But also, you know, it's one thing in the immediate post-war years to apply muscle and say, okay, this is what you've got to do. It's another thing after, you know, 13, 14, 15 years to do it. It becomes less and less legitimate politically over time. So, that's what I would say. I think I'm missing maybe part of your question, but I've probably forgotten it.
Maybe I can just add on to that. I mean, the other thing is that we're saying is that the European Union has to have a robust role as well. So we're not saying that the bond powers should be transferred to the an EU special representative. But one thing that we would think would be an ideal tool is that the new USR somehow serve as a guarantor of Dayton. So would be able at least to ring the alarm bells should there be a serious breach of the Dayton Accords, so that this person would be able to come and tell the member states, look, you must react now, and this is how you must react, because there's going to be a referendum, or because the Bosniak side is going to do away with Republika Srpska. And I think this is quite a novel idea. It's not an idea that's been proposed very widely, that the EU would have this guarantor powers. I don't know. It's not sure that all the member states would be interested in doing this, but so far in our discussions in Brussels, we have seen some interest in this idea. Ideally, this new reinforced USR would also have a UN mandate, would get a Security Council resolution backing these new powers. Of course, this is something that Russia is not particularly keen on providing. But again, there might be some way to negotiate such a thing. Finally, the USR would also have very concrete sanction mechanisms. For example, would be able to suspend the delivery of funds, would be able to impose visa bans, travel bans. And these don't sound like very much, perhaps, to an audience here in D.C., but no EUSR has these kind of powers. So it would also be really giving a new initiative to a representative. And these are the first ideas. I mean, it's something that, again, would take years to develop into a real robust power, but would already be much more than what you have anywhere else.
Could I just address the issue of the referendum? That's what I forgot to, and that's a good point. I mentioned the RS desire for independence, but not the threat to call a referendum, which Dodik has been talking about for about 3 years, off and on. In my view, the thing that prevents the RS from holding a referendum is the realization on their part that it is the only way that RS could be eliminated. Okay? If today they call a referendum and tomorrow they hold it, and the day after its results are rejected roundly by the international community, and they're aware that it would be rejected, maybe a few countries here and there would recognize it, but nowhere near a critical mass, they would open themselves to two things. One, armed action on the part of the more numerous and arguably stronger Bosniak community that would, at the very least, whittle away at the borders of RS, possibly leading to the loss of the whole eastern half of the country. And in a worst-case scenario, simply lead to the complete elimination of their entity. If the entity breaks away, that shatters the constitutional order of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and it allows the rump, so to speak, to rebuild it as it likes. Okay, so there are many bad outcomes to a referendum for the Serbs. There's the Northern Cyprus outcome, where they're sort of isolated and frowned upon by the international community for decades. There's what happened to the Serb Krajina in Croatia, where they simply disappeared. That's the worst possible outcome for them. But in some ways, the least likely is that they become a thriving independent state. And they are aware of that. So it's really that more than the strong arm in the international community that's preventing them from doing it, although the High Representative does still have the ability to act if they were to try.